The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know how well you can hear me, but I was listening to the music. It was all broken up. And so I'm asking Tan Stoffel, who I was talking, Skyping with just a few minutes ago, to send me a message and let me know how I'm doing here. Because I can't tell. I have... Let me just say that my guest didn't call in until the last minute, and then something was going wrong with answering it. So we have to do that. I'd have to tell him when to call. But if I'm not being heard properly, if I can't hear somebody talking to me, well, I guess I have to. What I have to do is ask Bruce to call in now, and. Boy, this is getting confusing. When people don't call earlier, like I asked them to, and then they wait, you know, then there's all these problems come up right at the last minute and the show is going on and I can't solve them. So let me send this message to Bruce. I've got my caps on here. And let me wait for his call. This is... I don't know for what happened to the sound I was hearing. I hope it's going to be all right. If not, we're going to have to close down and start over again. Here's his call. Here we go. There he is.
Here I am.
Yeah, hi, Bruce.
Hello, Carolyn.
Well, you sound fine. I don't hear that funny... breaking up. That's very good. And so I assume if I don't get a message from Tan that everything is all right and we're sounding all right. So good. Welcome. Gee, I've kind of screwed up my little opening here as to how I was going to start this. But I just wanted to, I haven't even welcomed the listeners yet and said that today is May 18th, 2013. And this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. And I just wanted, Bruce, if you just hold off just a second here, I want to right up front emphasize to listeners, because of some of the mail that I get, that what I'm doing with these interviews this month of May is to look into the history of the white racialist cause in this country by talking to those, some of those, who are still alive and are willing to talk. And, you know, I've only had two, and I was only going to be two more talking with you and then next Saturday. So it's not like it's a huge project going on here, but I'm not really trying to satisfy in any of these shows how this person I'm talking to, wants to present himself, individually or everything about him or everything he's done, but more how he fits into the so-called movement. I say so-called. Because, you know, we never liked that word too much. And so this is, in a sense, of illuminating where we've come from. And maybe it's a poor objective on my part, but that's how it was set up. So today, I'm very pleased that you're here, J. Bruce Campbell, and thank you for coming on with me.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Okay. So now now we're all set to go. And... you have, I'll just start out by pointing out that your website is a popular one. It's called Extremism Online. And if we go there, anybody goes there, the index page has an article that I take it that you see as very important or very representative of your thinking, which you wrote in September 2011, called The Military Solution. And you say on there, as a Rhodesian anti-terrorist in the early 70s, I figured that the combination of normal African cruelty with Jewish communism was the ultimate in political sadism. The atrocities I witnessed were shocking and revolting. Well, I like that very much, and it fits with the way that I see the problems that we have very well. You're talking about the Africans and the Jews and communism, and it also tells us that in the early 70s you were already an active participant in whatever we might call it, and you were working as in Rhodesia as an anti-terrorist, that is, on the side of the white Rhodesians, isn't that correct?
Yeah, it was the white minority government of Rhodesia that America and England swore to bring down in league with the Soviet Union and Red China. And Lyndon Johnson and Harold Wilson, the British Prime Minister in those days, went to the United Nations after Wilson had insisted that what it was called in those days, Southern Rhodesia, because there was Northern Rhodesia, Southern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland. It was kind of a federation. Northern Rhodesia, the whites there allowed the blacks to take over and rename the country, call it Zambia. And the dictator was Kenneth Kaunda. And they trusted Kaunda. I've talked to several Northern Rhodesian farmers who had Kaunda in their homes and in their meetings, promising that they would be protected under a black government. And of course, as soon as Northern Rhodesia became Zambia, the whites were disfranchised. Everything was taken from them, and they had to flee to the south, some into Southern Rhodesia, some to South Africa. Mm-hmm. So the Southern Rhodesians took note of that, and they took note of what happened in the Congo when the Belgians bugged out, and in Kenya, what happened there in the 50s. And they just said, well, no, we're not going to turn Southern Rhodesia over to the blacks. It's not going to happen because it is a total catastrophe. It has been a catastrophe everywhere in Africa, and it's not going to happen here. So Wilson went to Lyndon Johnson and complained and said, hey, these guys, you know, they're not going with the program. So the two of them went to the United Nations and insisted upon starvation, blockades, sanctions, declaring it an outlaw regime, and swore to starve it to death. And they did. They tried very hard. Rhodesia, about the size of Montana, somewhere between the size of Montana and California, landlocked country, surrounded by Mozambique, South Africa, Botswana, and Zambia, of course. So it was a very hard life for them.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I went down a few years later to help them to fight this horrible combination of America, England, Soviet Union, and Red China and the United Nations.
Right. And how long were you there?
2 years. I went there first in 71 on a business deal. I was a very young guy. I was sent over on a business deal to discuss the purchase of a minimum of 100 square miles for something called A New Constitution for a New Country, a book that had been written by Mike Oliver in Carson City. He sent me to British Honduras, to South Africa, and then Rhodesia to talk about this. And then it was not a successful thing, obviously. I came back and decided in January 73 to join up with them. And
okay.
So I was there 73 and 74.
All right. Well, that gave you, you know, a tremendous kind of experience. And, of course, what you point out there, the ones that you see as the evildoers, come up again in your latest article on your website, which I didn't actually find a way to navigate there without already having the URL from you, but it's entitled The Ugly American, and you wrote it just in May, on May the 12th you posted it, so, you know, a week ago or so, and if you want to talk just briefly about that, and then we'll go into the real topic of the program.
Yeah, well, excuse me. The Americans, we haven't covered ourselves in glory. Obviously, I think Americans are the main problem in the world. And I go into it pretty, in what I think is pretty reasonable fashion in that piece.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was pretty reasonable. You sound a little more, aggressive and so on against the United States and against America and so on. But this one I couldn't find anything to complain about or argue about it. And you do bring up the Jews. You do always see, even though you see America as a whole as being very violent and terrible, you do see the Jews as being the worst part of why things have turned that way, you might say, right?
Oh, yeah. Jewish, we're just America's just an instrument of Jewish thinking, Jewish policy, and it always has been, for at least since World War I, mm-hmm. probably before that. I mean, Alexander Hamilton, gave us the central private bank, the first bank in the United States, which was a Rothschild bank.
Yeah, but that was also British, and the British elite were very much in agreement with all of that at the time. So it was kind of a combination, right?
I mean, England is a totally Jewish-run island. I mean, there's no question that the Jews run England and the Jews run America through the Federal Reserve.
When do you think that started in England?
I guess with Rothschild when he took over the Bank of England and created the private thing called the Bank of England, which is Rothschild. So I would say that's the issue.
Okay. All right, well, let's move on to our movement here in the United States a little bit. And Bruce, you've been on my program. I guess I've done 3 programs with you, but not since I've been on the White Network, and that's a year now. So it's been a while. But I always like you. I always like what you say. I always agree with you. But sometimes I've had, a few questions that come up in my mind. And, one of them I'll bring up just right off the bat, which you might not like, but, I do notice that you don't write for Veterans Today anymore, and don't seem to be associated with that since, a year ago or so, right? Did you make a decision, not to do that? And because, I was always complaining and questioning your association with Gordon Duff, who is Jewish himself.
Well, he's,
apologist. Jewish. Well, he's half, he says, and he's apologist for Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's been a couple of years, actually, since I started my own website. And I think the issue for me was I was not comfortable with Gordon when he called for the invasion of Libya. And I just could not be associated with Veterans Today after that. And I was not comfortable with the whole overall thing. I mean, he told me that I was the toughest guy on there, and I I raised the readership tremendously because of the stuff I was writing. But I still felt subject to some censorship, even if it was self-censorship. So I had to be independent, and that's why I left Veterans Today.
Well, good. You have been writing on your own website, and you were doing it, I think, because of as so many people have done, because of the large readership there. But I think it's not as large as it used to be, but that's not the issue today. So, okay, thanks for answering that. Now, when I contacted you about this, this program, I was wanting to get a hold of I'm not going to think of his name right off the bat here, like a dummy.
Oh, Louis.
Louis Beam, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I looked at his website, but I saw that he had said there that he wasn't interested in doing any interviews, and there wasn't any way to contact him on there. So I wrote to you or Skyped you and asked you about it, and you told me that he would not get on the radio anymore.
Yeah.
So I believed you. And, as you have said before, you were and are friends with him. I was very, very interested in him because he's quite he's a person who was very involved back in the 80s and 90s, and then has you know, not spoken out for a long time, and has even kind of moderated his views. And I've put a lot of I finally today read more of his website, I'm a little bit I've got some quotes to come up with coming up that to just talk about where he actually stands today. He's not nearly where he used to be, that might be one reason why he doesn't want to take interviews, because he doesn't want to have to go over all that stuff. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about him, if you can answer any of these things about him, that questions that I have. So, how well do you know him, and what has been your relationship?
Well, we've been very close friends since we first met in 1990 in Colorado. I was starting my big speaking tour around the country to start the militia going. And we agreed to meet at a retreat in Colorado. And I was totally unaware of Lewis. I didn't know anything about him. I'd heard a speech that he gave at Pulaski, Tennessee, which blew me away. I had no idea that America had such an orator.
Yeah, what year was this that he gave this speech?
We met.
Remember?
Oh, the year he gave the speech?
Yeah, the speech you heard that blew me away.
Well, I think it was probably in 1988, but I'm not sure. 88, was, of course, was the year of the great sedition trial that he was in. But he went to Pulaski and gave a fantastic speech. It was probably 88 or 89, because I didn't hear it till 1990, just before I think we met, a few months before we met. Mm-hmm. He wrote me, he'd seen my book. Somebody sent him my book, and he liked it. So he said, you know, I was pushing something called leaderless resistance a few years ago, and I kind of let it go. I said, well, that sounds good. That's kind of like what I'm doing with this militia thing. I encouraged him to re-release it, spruce it up, and put it out again. And he did. And so the two of us, he was pushing leaderless resistance, and I was pushing the militia thing, which was essentially leaderless resistance. So together we kind of were doing the same thing at the same time in the late 80s and early 90s.
My thing with names now. My guest from Monday, isn't this awful? Believe me, folks, I'm not losing my mind, but I get this mental block on names.
Oh, you mean Glenn Miller?
No, the next one.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't hear it.
Oh, this is unbelievable.
You mean Metzger?
Yes, thank you.
Tom Metzger?
Tom Metzger, yes. Because he thought he picked that idea up around the same time Lewis Beam talked about it. So do you, you don't know Tom Metzger. You didn't ever run into Tom Metzger.
No, I never did.
Well, he has this thing called lone wolf operations and so on, which he says is the same thing as leaderless resistance. It basically is. So a lot of people, but you know, this whole idea is old. I mean, this is not new, but it was just that it appealed to certain people at this point in time because of the difficulties that were foreseen, I guess.
Well, what Lewis experienced in the Klan led him to promote that, because the Klan was a federal sting operation. It still is, as far as I know. Anybody in the Klan is probably a Fed. It's like anybody in the militia today is, you know, must be viewed with suspicion, because the Feds have taken it over, anything. And so Lewis and I were trying to figure out ways of a resistance movement that could not be infiltrated. That's the only idea.
Right. Got that. Okay, well, let me ask you this. Now, this is always kind of bugged me. And I don't know, you've answered it before, but it never seemed like real good answers, Bruce. But and maybe it's just that's just the way it is. But you know, it seems like you were quite involved in the history of the times. Not only did you have this background in Rhodesia, but you then did who knows what, and then you wrote this book, which didn't get published. You didn't publish until 89. But you were traveling around, and you have said that that you've been on the FBI terrorism list since 1980 something, and yet at the same time your name never comes up by anybody. I mean, why is that? Now hear me say, Louis Beam does not mention you on his site. It doesn't mean a lot because he probably doesn't mention hardly anybody else. So, but you have no Wikipedia entry.
I have no what?
Wikipedia entry. And you, the SPLC has never written up a story on you. They've even written one on me. And so has the ADL. But the ADL has never written about you either. And I searched on that, and there's a comment on each of those sites, but it has to do with just somebody else, and it's really just not much. Actually, the ADL has posted a 2012 press TV appearance you made with Michael Santomaro and Allison Weir, and they just call you an anti-Semitic writer for Veterans Today. That's what they called you on there, and you were on this phone interview. But, you know, there's nothing about your background, nothing about the militia or anything. And so, you know, I wonder how you explain that. When I Google you on, my Google you name, all I come up with are a few radio programs and, Veterans Today articles. And now your website, some things on your own website. Why is it that, that you, are so under the radar there?
Well, it's going to sound like bragging, and I don't like to do this. But
go ahead, whatever it is.
Since you're asking the question, it's pretty obvious, you know, that nobody in the country writes or says the things that I do, and the last thing that the Jews want to do, the last thing that the feds want to do, is bring any attention to what I'm doing. There's nothing more powerful. I mean, look, correct me if I'm wrong, but is there anything more powerful than my material? I mean, I'm calling for the killing of various enemies of the people. Nobody right. does that except for me. Now, I'll give you a story, an indication of what is really going on. When I was in Montana, you know, up there trying to help these federal pigs called the Trockmans, they were working for the FBI and the ATF, and their militia of Montana it may still be, I don't even know if it's in existence anymore, but in the 90s, it was a federal sting operation, an FBI sting operation. The Trockmans right. were working for the FBI. Well, Lewis and I went up there because I'd been in the Northridge earthquake in L.A. The house was destroyed. I got Lewis to babysit the remodeling of the place. Luckily, I just bought insurance on it, so I was able to relocate someplace. I had to get the hell out of L.A. So he and I took a trip up to Montana. He introduced me to the Trockmans.
And this was after you had done all this work traveling around talking about the militia as a just to independent.
Yeah, that was in 1990. This was in early 94.
Right.
So we went up and I met the Trockmans, and I found a house, and I said, "Okay, we're going to move up here." So I rented a place in Knoxon where the militia of Montana was. And within a couple of months, we moved up there. So, a few months after that, I finally realized the Trockmans were working for the feds. And I dropped out of the whole thing. But I met this guy, Brandon Short, and I had a little business up there. So he came over to look and see what it was. And he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm so-and-so." And what are you doing here? I said, I came up here to help the truckmans. It turned out to be a bunch of finks. Oh, okay. And I revealed that I had written a book, and he said, what book is that? I said, well, it's The New American Man. Oh, my God, you wrote that? So he said, I have that book. So we became friends. And it turned out he was up there built with his father to have a ammunition manufacturing company. And they had a private investigative service in the Bay Area of California. So as the time went on, I said, you know, I've been trying to get my Freedom of Information Act file, my FBI file. And they say it's going to take 4 years. And I know it's going to be heavily redacted. It's going to be all blacked out. I've seen Lewis's. It's all blacked out. Oh, he said, I can get you your FBI file with no blackouts right away. Really? Yeah. Just give me your full name, your date of birth, and your Social Security number. I'll get it for you. Well, right on. So within a week, he called me and says, who in the hell are you? Why? Well, my partner in San Francisco went to get your file, and he got dragged down to the FBI, and they said, who, what are you doing? What are you doing trying to get this guy's file? Well, and he, you know, the guy was pretty nervous. He said, well, I don't really know. Well, you do not want to mess with this guy. Leave this alone. If you do it again, you're going to go to prison.
Now, who was, why does this guy have the, can anybody go and get these FBI files?
I guess if you have a high-powered investigative agency, you know, you might have the power. If you've got connections in the Department of Justice, you can probably get it. That's what this guy was able to do. Brandon Short told me that he did it all the time for guys, get their FBI files with no blackout. Well, he couldn't get it for me. So, and then Brandon was killed about 2 months later. So, you know, it was all very unfortunate business. But I got an insight into what the FBI really thinks about me. And, of course, then the two agents came to my house a few months later. And they told me, you know, what they think of me. And they said, you know, we know you started the militia. You were a mercenary in Africa. You blah, 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 did all these interesting things. And we were hoping we could start a dialogue with you. I said, with me? Well, it may not work out, this guy said. And these are the people the Trockmans were working for out of Missoula. I said, okay. I mean, you give me full disclosure. Oh, he said, I couldn't do that. Well, no, neither could I. So let's forget it. So immediately I got online and I said, hey, the FBI has come to my house. They want, you know, they're trying to get me on online. So to answer your question, I would humbly say that they do not want anybody to be any more aware of me than what it already is. That's a very simple, but I would say truthful answer. I got too much going. I got too much hardcore material that they do not want looked at by a great number of people.
What do you mean by hardcore material? You mean...
So do you know anybody? Have you ever heard of anybody in the world?
Oh, you mean what you've written?
Yeah, who writes or says the things I say on the radio?
No, that's why it turns out to be, you know, that you could be suspected of. How do you get away with this? And nobody's bothering you and you never hear anything about you.
Well,
but what you're saying, now, well, let me put it in my words. I think it's, it makes sense too, that, that since so much of this, stuff to scare white people by saying, oh, there's all these fanatical right wingers, you know, want to do violence and so on. Since they run so much of it, they play that up. They play all these people up, and some of them are aware of it, are involved, and some aren't. But the real people, they don't want anyone to hear about.
Exactly. Now, my friend, my dear friend Louis Beam, unfortunately, you know, he was at the top of the Jews' hate list after Dr. Mengele was finally admitted to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the top for a long time. But after Mengele was found to be dead, Louis Beam went to the top of the hate list of the Jews. Well, Louis, you know, as I'm sure he would admit, has got this Klan baggage like David Duke.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes him an attractive boogeyman for the Jews. But I am not an attractive boogeyman for the Jews because I don't have any baggage. And I don't have any really, you know, I don't have anything that they can hold against me that they want known. I mean, I got a lot of stuff in my background. They don't want it known. So that's about the easiest and the most simplified way I can explain this, why I'm not on the hate list.
Okay, well, let me interject here before we go any further about this Mark Kernke that I've been that is on this Liberty Tree Radio, which our Jewish fellow correspondent Stuart keeps always wanted to recommend and still recommends. And I finally went and listened to Mark a radio program by Mark Kornke, and it sounded I didn't like it at all. It just sounds like the usual Patriot junk, although you know, his fans insist that he's really telling the real thing, and they're forming this militia thing. Well, anyway, it's anything but a leaderless resistance. And then I brought him up to you, and you said, yeah, you knew him, and you want to tell your story about Mark Kernke.
I don't know him.
No, you don't know.
No, I never knew him. I never knew him.
But you know of him. You said you were in Montana. You said he was, you were in Montana, and he was giving a speech.
Yeah, he came to Knoxon because the truckmans invited him to come, and it was a big deal.
That was before you knew that the truckmans were.
No! I'd already divorced myself from the truckmans, but because there was this big appearance by Kernke, and I think there were some others. There were some other personalities in the movement, but he was kind of the star of the show. So I just went out, as I said, out of curiosity to see what he was going to say, because as I told you, I mean, he doesn't go on about the Jews. He doesn't even discuss the Jews, mm-hmm. probably because he's German, and German Americans are the most useless bastards on the face of this earth. You know, they will not defend themselves. They will not say a god darn thing. So,
and you know, Stuart is Jewish, which he finally disclosed to us. So, and he really likes this Mark Kernke.
He would, because
yeah,
like
right.
Alex Jones, you know, they're militant as hell. They get people all cranked up, but they send them in the wrong direction, which is perfect.
Right.
That's what the Jews want. Mm-hmm. Stuart. I remember Stuart. What's his first name? I can't remember.
That's his first name, Stuart.
Oh.
I don't know his last name.
Oh, I don't. Oh, okay. There was a publisher, I mean, a Jew that was a famous guy.
Not famous.
Okay.
He's just called this program.
I see.
He's a real nice fellow, and he voluntarily eventually told us he was Jewish, and that changed everything, because we have a policy no Jews on the White Network, and I don't think he realized that. So, he's been nice. He still sends me emails, and he's still I hear him on some other shows. He's still promoting this Liberty Tree and the militia. Now, this is all supposed to be the real militia. These are the real militia guys. And you're saying that when you did listen to that speech, you told me that Kernke wants to present himself as being the kind of the big militia leader guy, but you said he did reluctantly say that you some things about you being starting it.
Yeah, somebody brought up the fact that I'd started the whole thing, and he nodded and said, yeah, that's true. And but
okay.
I mean, as I say, the whole problem with everything in terms of resistance is the cult of the personality. And this is what I was assiduously, you know, studiously trying to avoid. The same with Lewis. We were both attempting to avoid the cult of the personality, which always destroys every movement. Now, I started this militia thing because, just my research, I wanted to start a resistance movement. I didn't know what to call it or really anything, but so I started investigating the militia. I didn't even know what it was.
And what made you want to start this? I mean, after you came back from Rhodesia, I don't want to make you, you don't, of course, you know, you don't have to say anything you don't want to say, but what were you doing then between then and say the late 80s or whenever you, wow, you said you actually wrote this book in 83. So you
yeah.
were, this was all fomenting around in your mind, and you were probably working, right, making a living and so on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I went to Rhodesia. My father suggested I get the hell out of the country because I told him I was going to kill Henry Kissinger. He said, I don't think that's a hell of a good idea. You better just, you're too hot.
Okay.
You better go someplace else.
So this goes back. Why don't you tell us maybe, just, I don't want to lose the train here, but, you know, when did you first get radical. I remember now reading some articles by you about how gun wise you were as a kid and how you grew up, and you always knew about guns and were familiar with guns. But when did you get understanding about people like Kissinger and so on?
Well, I guess I really came to age in 1968 when I was in college. I mean, I'd been in England. I was over there racing cars, being a big-time bum in 67. I was in Australia in 65. But in 67 in England, I started reading political stuff and trying to learn about communism and socialism and stuff like that. So by the time I got back to America in 68 and went back to college, I was pretty radical and pretty anti-communist, pretty liberal and the whole thing, and not really understanding Jews yet, but getting there. And so I guess that's when I really started to develop my anti-government, my revolutionary fervor to overthrow the government. That is my ambition. That's always been my ambition since 1968, is to overthrow the federal government by force and violence. I'm not trying to do it democratically or politically or peacefully, because it can't be done. America is a violent revolutionary country. It was founded in violence and revolution, and it has to be run that way. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, except what way possible could the few people that want to do this ever actually do it?
We need more people, and that's our job, is to create more revolutionaries. That's what we have to do. Now I'm finally coming into my own. It's only been since 1968 that I've been pushing this. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult, you know, a lot of inertia. America was not ready for this. And America has to be humiliated before it can become revolutionary. And now we're about to become very humiliated. I was humiliated. I was out of work for a year and a half. You talk about humiliation.
Yeah, for you that is. It's not for everybody, but for you that is. Is that when I was when you were on my program or right before that, and you were saying you're out of work and you hated it and you?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was
talking about an earlier time.
I can't remember, but I was out of work for a year and a half, and it was the most degrading, humiliating experience. So. I mean, I didn't need that to become a revolutionary, because I was already a revolutionary, but just the way it happened. Now, I'm back at work.
Who was the first person you met and got associated with in this revolutionary sense? Were there people before Louis Beam?
No, I started it. Let's face it.
Okay. You did it all on your own. You started thinking about this, and you started thinking about how you could go about this resistance and building it up, and that's what turned into the militia movement.
Yeah, I mean, the militia. Right. The militia was traditionally, as I wrote in the last piece, it was a force for the government. It was an auxiliary for the government under Washington and under these other guys. They used it to put down freedom movements. So when I chose the word the militia as an anti-government group, you know, or state of, that's all it was a state of mind. There was nothing to join. There was no way to join the militia that I started. It was just a state of mind. Guys, according to the government, several million guys came up with this idea. They think, well, I'm in the militia. Well, okay, fine. I mean, I was just trying to get a group of guys to help me overthrow the government. And it didn't work out that way. What it worked out to was guys bought a bunch of guns and ammo. They didn't do anything with them. They just bought guns and ammo. And they, you know, had a militant attitude. Well, that was enough for the government to become very uneasy. And they didn't like it, because it came out of left field. And they used their own word against them. I mean, Oliver North got on the bandwagon. He tried to start a state militia thing. You know, he tried to take it over and turn it back into what it really is a force for tyranny. But it didn't work out. And it took whatever the Clintons did, whatever anybody did, it didn't, nothing worked until Oklahoma City. And then that killed it overnight. But it took that to destroy this concept. So we don't talk about the militia anymore. You know, we just talk about resistance or revolution or whatever. I mean, we don't even need any kind of a thing anymore. We just have to have an attitude that we have to overthrow this stinking government. And
okay, yeah, because you've said that you've said often that the militia died with Oklahoma City, and then you, now lately, more lately, you've said it's a good thing it died. It was, you know, it wasn't the right thing anyway, and
it had a window. It had a window of opportunity to overthrow the government, and it missed it. So, like any organization or anything that looks like it's going to be dangerous to the government or to the Jews, it has to be infiltrated.
Yeah.
And it was heavily infiltrated, and so it became useless. It became a liability. You don't want anything to do with that word anymore. Believe me, that's not, you know, just don't want to have that, you know, forget that. It was a thing that lasted from 89 to 95, and then it ended.
Yeah. It lasts, yeah, till 95. Okay. So in the meantime there, did you ever go to Elohim City?
Oh, no. Hell no. I mean, see, that was a combination of a Christian identity, bunch of crackpots, and federal agents. It was run by Reverend Robert Millar, who turned out to be a confidential informant for the FBI.
Are you sure? Was he always? You think he always was? He was an FBI.
He was identified in court in Houston. The FBI agent got up in court and on the witness stand in Houston in some federal trial against the one of their informants, and said that Robert Millar was a confidential informant for the FBI.
Oh yeah, that's it.
They
might turn. A lot of people do that when they are, you know, secretly arrested or approached or something, and said they're going to be charged with this, that, and the other thing, and so then they decide to cooperate. But they didn't necessarily start out that way. I think
it doesn't matter.
It might not matter, but it kind of makes a difference. People get scared, and all kinds of people have done that.
Hey, that's
all
too bad. You know, that's too damn bad to get scared. Yeah. I mean, this is life and death. So you don't get scared. You either come clean or you drop out, but you don't stay in it and bring people in and be reporting like John Trockman to the FBI every day with all the new names you got. That's what Millar was doing. He's an informant. He's a fink.
Yeah, like so now I don't want to forget this, so I'm going to bring this up, and then we'll talk about Oklahoma City. Do you consider yourself a leader?
A leader?
Yes. I want to ask this because, you know, I made the distinction between leaders and writers and so on, and I think that leaders are very rare, real leaders, and so I'm bringing that up to you. Kind of like the Order, like Bob Matthews of the Order is considered a leader because he actually took action and he did it himself. And it's often said that a leader leads, you know, and doesn't expect people to do what he hasn't done. And in fact, I've got a quote down here from Lewis Beam about precepts of leadership. And he says the most important principle of leadership is to lead by example. If at all possible, a leader should have already done that which he will ask others to do. And if you ask people to do that which you haven't done, you're a commander, maybe, but not a leader. But things like that. So I'm looking to find out who people think are leaders. So apart from, do you think you are a leader? And also, who do you think is a leader and has been a leader?
There's been no leaders. America?
Yeah.
No, there's been nothing.
So there's no one in the United States in this whole history of this so-called movement or whatever that has been a real leader.
No, there's been no revolutionary group to overthrow the government led by somebody. No, there's been nobody. I mean, I'm the one that's spearheading this thing now. I mean, I started it. I started doing this back in 83, and I carefully kept my personality out of it. I did not want a cult of the personality because that would destroy it, and it always destroys it because the leader You know, I don't believe in the leader principle, the Führer Prinzip. I mean, it worked for Hitler.
Different situation, wasn't it?
Different situation. And he had a homogenous population of people who were very hardworking and were so humiliated by their experience at American hands after World War One. And he was somebody who was able to enunciate great truths to a people who honestly were not that switched on. I mean, there was a huge membership of the Communist Party in Germany that he had to deal with. So, I mean, the German people need a leader. And they, when they got one, they responded beautifully. But it was hard. America's is not anywhere near like that. So, you can be a small time leader if that's what turns you on. But that's not what we need here. We need a movement. We need a general appreciation of the rightness and wrongness of things, and that's what. And then acting on that to overthrow the government. I mean, the only thing that matters in America is to overthrow the government. That's all. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
This is America. It was founded in revolution against tyranny. And if we don't do it ourselves, then we're failures. We're total failures, and we've been failures ever since the Constitution was jammed down our throats. The Constitution is the problem. And
make a case for that. Well, yeah. Well, before we get into that, sticking with the leader thing. Well, then you are I don't know if you're for or against or just neutral on leaderless resistance. I guess that's the way you would think it would have to go, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you have some guys that you trust, that's, you know, more power to you. But that's hard to do these days in this country. Like I said in my latest piece, I mean, most Americans are no damn good. That's something we got to face. Most of us are no damn good. Ain't worth the powder to blow us away. Consumed by sports and sex and stupid religion and God knows what, entertainment, anything to avoid our duty to overthrow this government.
And so the government. Don't you think the first thing that anybody who's serious about any of this, it says they're serious and wants to go around saying, white power and so on. The first thing that they should do is turn off their TV or get rid of their TV. I mean, what is it with all these people? We talk about the Jewish media, and yet they're taking it in all the time.
Well, yeah.
That's the first thing. That's just the beginning thing that people should do.
Yeah, right.
If they can't even do that, what are they going to do?
It's extremely seductive. So, yes, I agree. And we don't have television, so I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, well, I can do it too. And once you've done it for a while, you don't miss it. But I think a lot of these people who think they need to watch and see what's going on and check out the enemy and so on, it's just that it's, as you said, the seductive part. They don't want to look at it on the internet, or they don't want to hear about it from here and there, because you can find everything out without having television. But they like that big color screen, I guess, you know, and I know it is, although it's sickening when you see what's actually on it. But, well, yeah. That's just simple things that people should be, you know, should be forced down into everybody's mind, that they really, we need to quit watching Jewish television. So,
it's called the Jewish toilet. They flush it goes right into their brains.
Right. And so what else needs to be done?
We have a terrible problem with police brutality. And this is my real, revelation that has hit me. I mean, after all these years, I finally seized upon a basic principle, and that is that the police are our enemies by their very nature. I don't care if a cop is a nice guy. I don't care, like I said, if he likes the Red Sox or if he keeps his shoes shined or if he has a nice dog. A policeman has a license to kill us. For any reason or for no reason at all. And this is the issue. No decent person would accept a license to kill. No decent person. I mean, it comes to your house, you might call the cops for something, comes to your house, chances are he's going to shoot you these days, or beat you, or tase you, or do something horrible, and get away with it. So my position now is that cops are fair game. They are the enemy. Feds, cops, whoever's got the license to kill, IRS agents, I mean, I don't care. Doesn't matter. That is the issue now. I mean, I'm not about this. I'm about overthrowing the government, the invisible government, the Federal Reserve, the Council on Foreign Relations. These are my bete noir. But I have to face facts. You know, we got to deal with cops day to day. So how to do this is you got to be ready to kill. And this is where I'm different. And I'm pushing this because this is fundamental. These guys can kill us at the drop of a hat. And they do. Every day, cops are killing people. They come into the wrong house and they kill you. I mean, what they do to people these days is unspeakable. So we have to be ready at the drop of a hat to defend ourselves from these guys.
So anyway, you know, you say this, and what strikes me is that are you telling people to go out and do this?
I'm not saying to go out.
You're not doing it.
I'm not saying to go out and do this. I'm not saying to go hunting cops now.
Yeah.
Okay. May come to that. But what I'm saying now is that if any cop looks like he's going to hurt you, then you kill him. That's what I'm saying.
And you know, when defense, you kill a cop, you're going to go to prison.
No, but you're going to have to kill some more. You're going to have to keep killing. Yeah. Now,
how do you know if they're going to kill you? What about these roadblocks? You've written and said, well, if you come to a roadblock, you got to just smash right through it and shoot and so on. How smart is that?
That's one way. I mean, we have to grow up. We have to become adults here and stop asking permission from cops and governments and whatever to go about our business. They have to become more afraid of us than we are of them. And until that happens, we've got tyranny. So we have to be the boss. We pay the bills. We're the boss. We got to act like the boss. That's all I'm saying. And I'm not saying to go out and start killing.
Well, then you're trying to change people's mental state. It's like you're talking to a bunch of people who have to sit around and watch their TV programs every night, and then they're going to somehow grow up and become, you know.
Yeah, I'm not talking to those people. Obviously, I'm not talking to those people. I'm not talking to most Americans. I'm talking to some. And yeah. I'm planning to get this thing spread. I'm trying to spread this word. You know, that's how things happen. They happened in Germany this way. Started with seven guys, or five guys or whatever. And it grew. Because the truth sometimes does leak out. And it's appealing to people. So what I did with the militia was I glorified the thing and I glamorized it. And men, you know, in those days in the early 80s, the mid 80s, men were not so manly. I'm not saying they are today, but back in the 80s, they definitely were not. And I was saying, no, we got to be men. You know, men have to protect women and children. And, you know, that's our duty. That's where we're different. And it struck a chord and it appealed to a lot of guys. And, you know, it's centered around guns and ammo. Okay. But it started something and it never has ended. There's still this tendency now. It's because, boy, I mean, you know, gun sales are through the roof. Ammunition sales, you know, it's unavailable. So there is a difference now that did not exist back then until I started this militant voluntary, the biggest voluntary armed movement in probably in world history, the fastest growing voluntary armed movement. And,
well, what was the Klan doing all that time? I mean, all these people that I was surprised. I had no idea that Glenn Miller was in the Klan all those years, and that his group was Klan until the very end. Well, I guess it always was. And then Tom Metzger was a Klan leader, and all these people were in the Klan. What was their message at that time? And of course, David Duke. I shouldn't ignore David Duke. He was the biggest one in the Klan. So, But what message did the Klan have? It was mostly, what, some kind of racial message and scaring? I don't know. You know, nobody was, you know, what does it all amount to? I kind of understand where you're coming from, because it just, it's all like kind of showy, but it's not going to. And it makes other people scared of you. So, yeah, it would be something that the government and the Jews would want white people to be doing.
Oh, yeah. That's straight out of Hollywood Central Casting. Mm-hmm. Wearing those crazy robes and pointy hats. I mean, my God, that's undignified as hell. It was just embarrassing to see these jerks acting that way.
Well, so, there's something to it. I don't want to call them jerks, and I don't feel that bad about them. But yeah, if, we got 60 seconds until our break. Will you go ahead and say, finish off what you want to say about this before our break, and then we'll.
Well, they were a bunch of phonies, and they were so heavily infiltrated by the FBI, it was pointless. I mean, but why wear those stupid sheets?
Because it was traditional, started way back.
Nathan Bedford Forrest started it out of desperation during Reconstruction, and it lasted for a few years until Grant said, if you don't stop this, Forrest, we're going to have another civil war. We're going to come down there and do the same thing to you we did a few years ago. So the Klan, the real Klan, ended. Bedford Forrest stopped it.
Okay, I'm going to break you off there. I want to tell people that I've got new break music today, and it is by Dresden, Call of the Blood. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. I'm Carolyn, and my guest is J. Bruce Campbell. And I just want to tell you again that that was new break music for this show, Call of the Blood by Dresden. It's, you know, I picked it out because it's in English, and it was available in the right length. I like it. It's nice words. It's hard to find music with English wording. I'm usually doing German. So, but I don't think it's the greatest music. It, you know, the music melody or whatever doesn't appeal to me all that much. But anyway, that's what we've got for a while. And so, Bruce, welcome back to you too. And, you know, this has been very interesting so far. So I'm so pleased that we're doing this show here today. We're just getting to the Oklahoma City bombing, and you know, this was also, in your estimation, a government operation. Is that right?
Absolutely. Government and Mossad. Yeah.
Okay. Well, now, tell us why, you know, your reasoning on that and why you think it is. Of course, there's a lot. I agree. I don't know about the Mossad, but why do you add the Mossad in there?
Well, because of Strassmeyer. And the fact that Southern Poverty Law Center had been monitoring or following McVeigh for 2 years. Well, Southern Poverty Law Center is Mossad.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I gathered from what you, I'd never heard that before. Of course, it's all tied in, you know, it's all Jewish, but you say that it's not just American Jews, but Mossad that is actually behind the SPLC. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, but the main thing is that Tim McVeigh was working for the, you know, the special forces, the U.S. Army combination of CIA and U.S. Army, which is the special forces. And that was, the legend was that he had applied for special forces, but had a new pair of boots and got a blister on his heel and washed out. But he wrote a letter to his sister Jennifer, which was read on the stand in Denver. She read it on the stand and said that he was working for this this group that was infiltrating. He thought it was going to be going against drug dealers, and he'd be breaking the law. What was it called? The I can't remember right now. But anyway, it was special forces, and turns out he wasn't going against drug dealers. He was going against the militia movement, and he presented himself as an angry racist, hawking copies of the Turner Diaries at gun shows around the country. Now, this guy, I did some research on this. I went down to Arizona where he lived, and I did a couple of big articles on a guy named Mike Gadbaugh, who was his roommate in Kingman, in the Kingman area of Arizona, just before he went to Kansas and Oklahoma, and McVeigh was impoverished working at an Ace Hardware. excuse me.
That's right.
Working at an Ace Hardware store and had no money. I asked Gadbaugh, how did you meet McVeigh? Well, he said, we were introduced by the guy that Tom, somebody that ran the Disabled American Veterans, which is part of the VA. But he said, it's kind of funny because Tim wasn't disabled. Anyway, they became roommates, and he told me that Strassmeyer visited him there at the house, and Richard Guthrie, and various guys from Elohim City, and you know what became the Midwest bank robbery gang, who were all involved in some extent in Oklahoma City. Now Strassmeyer, you know, was the key. Mm-hmm. Strassmeyer, I think he's married to an Israeli gal. He's, you know, he's a very effective military police agent for the German government. And then that Louis Free made an arrangement with Germany in the 90s to bring down the white racial movement in America. And so the next thing that happened was, well, in 88, rather, in the 80s, I take it back, not the 90s, in the 80s, Louis Free did this And so Lewis and Butler and Miles, Bob Miles, they were on trial in Fort Smith with convicts. I mean, here these guys were convicted, like 11 or so many guys. They were already convicted. And the feds brought these convicts in to be co-defendants with Lewis and Butler and Miles in the Fort Smith sedition trial, which Lewis single-handedly destroyed. I mean, it's the most fantastic story.
Well, now, you never had any contact or any connection with the Aryan Nations or Richard Butler, is that right?
Well, I met him. You know, Lewis took me to Aryan Nations, and I met Butler. Mm-hmm. And I said, Lewis, I got to get out of here. Why? I don't like it here. I don't like this thing. This is not healthy. There's something wrong. He said, well, you know, there's a lot of feds here. Well, then let's get the hell out of here. He said, oh, it's a lot of feds. It's heavily infiltrated. I said, well, what the hell are we doing here? I mean, my God. So it turns out that Butler, my friend Sherry Seymour, a great, great investigative reporter and journalist.
A woman.
Sherry. She knew Butler quite well and got a copy just by happenstance of a document from the CIA from its old headquarters in D.C. before it went to Langley, saying that the Aryan Nations was a CIA operation and had to be protected. So it freaked her out. She immediately left Idaho and went down to L.A. And a couple of years later, she finally got the nerve to go back and see Butler. They went to a restaurant for lunch. And on the way, she said, what do you think about the CIA? He looked at her. She said, this kindly old grandfatherly act evaporated. And he looked like he was going to kill her. And she was alarmed all over again. And he finally kind of relaxed and said, well, they saved my life at Fort Smith. You know, they paid for my open heart surgery. So the Aryan
CIA
Nations.
The CIA paid for his open heart surgery.
See, the whole Aryan Nations, the whole identity, the Christian identity movement, much of the Patriot movement is a government operation, a CIA operation, and has been from the very beginning. Butler and
Well, you think the Christian identity started out and then the government infiltrated?
No, the CIA created the Christian identity movement.
Why would they come up with such an idea to create?
I
find that kind of strange.
They've got psychiatrists, they've got psychologists working around the clock on how to infiltrate things and set up things and create boogeymen and whatever. I mean, that's all they do.
But that's just your opinion because you don't have any proof that it is that way. You don't have any proof that the CIA started Christian identity because there was a history to it that goes back.
Well, it was started by, you know, Colonel William Potter Gale and Sheldon Emery and I can't remember the other guy. But anyway, they're all from Lockheed and from the military industrial complex. The whole thing started in the military under the MacArthur guys. A lot of the former guys under MacArthur started this Christian identity thing, and based on British Israel. You know, the whole idea that the rabbis conned the British government is saying, you people are one of the lost tribes. You know, don't kick us out of England because we're brothers. And the English fell for it. They let the Jews stay in England and brought more in. British Israel. And that's all Christian identity is. But it's a military operation.
Did Louis Beam know all this? He was Christian identity for the longest time.
He didn't know it.
Even in the 90s, he was writing as a Christian identity.
Yeah, he didn't realize that. I mean, we've had a lot of discussions, and I had to, you know, I had to say, Louis, come on, man. Strassmeyer, you know, he knew Strassmeyer, and he got fooled by him. He knew Dave Holloway real well. Dave Holloway went down to Mexico and got Sheila out of prison. Well, who the hell is Dave Holloway? He's Special Forces, CIA, and an admitted FBI informant. When he went up to the Montana deal with the Freeman, he introduced himself to the FBI agent there and said, "Hey, I work for Robin so-and-so, FBI agent in Houston. I'm an informant." It's all in the 301 file. I mean, you know, the whole right wing was created by the federal government. Sherry Seymour and her husband Roland went down to Arizona, and they met with the guy, Pete Peters' buddy, this pastor, and said, "We want to get involved with the Patriot movement. Who should we see?" And this guy, what the hell was his name? Earl somebody. Anyways.
Well, while you're thinking about it, you know, there are a lot of pastors who head these right-wing groups from the past.
Earl Jones.
And even today. Yeah. Earl Jones.
Earl Jones. He was with Pete Peters. And Pete Peters is a, you know, anyway, I'll go into that some other time. But Earl Jones said, and Earl Jones was CIA. He was a scientist in the rocket program, and he was a CIA informant and agent. He said, "Well, there's only one guy in the country that's not with the government, and that's Campbell." So, and I never knew Earl. Maybe I'd met him. But anyway, that's how he told Sherry and Roland Seymour. So they came up to Montana and got, and that's how we met, because they said, "Earl Jones says you're the only guy that's not working for the government in the whole country." I said, "Well, that's probably true."
I mean, you know, that sounds strange to say.
Lewis is not. I mean, I got to get straight right now. Lewis is not. But Lewis will be the first to tell you that practically everybody in this stinking movement is compromised.
Okay, so, well, what about Tom Metzger? I wouldn't think he was.
Well, you know, when Morris Dees won that huge judgment against Metzger and whatever his outfit was called. Mm-hmm. He took over his everything. He took over his whole operation, took over his post office box, got the key to it, and people were still sending Metzger money. And Morris Dees just kept taking the money, and Metzger never told anybody to stop sending money because, you know, he was forbidden, and he let people keep sending money, and Morris Dees was getting it. So, I mean, I don't like that. I don't like that type of weakness. I don't care what the person is or was. It's not acceptable behavior.
Well, what about, so then you think Glenn Miller is not, maybe he wasn't, but he's just another weak person who's just doing his Klan thing, even though he knows it's full of feds. Because
He was a Fed.
Well, he testified, but he wasn't a Fed doing all that.
He got a lot of money from the Feds. He was a hired prostitute for the Feds. I mean,
when?
When?
What years?
In the 80s.
What are you talking about?
And he testified against the guys at Fort Smith.
Well, yeah, he did that.
He was a federal fink.
Well,
come on. Let's call a spade a spade. Let's not beat around the bush. I mean,
you know what? If they, when you have a family and when you have,
come on. This is life and death. You don't do this. This is not acceptable behavior.
Well, you know, you're not going to find too many people who aren't going to do it because it seems like everybody does. People are turning and talking all the time and these trials and giving, you know, becoming government witnesses all the time. And you're saying though that they always were with the government. I don't think that's would be necessarily true.
I'm not saying they're always war with the government. I'm just saying once the government approaches you, you say no. And if they, you know, here's what happened to Randy Weaver. They said, we want you, because of your background in the military, we want you to infiltrate the Aryan Nations in Hayden Lake, Idaho. He said, okay. He didn't want to do it, but he did. He went along and he went to the meetings, a few meetings. And I suppose he made his reports. Then they said, okay, there's these guys, the Trockmans out there in Knoxon, Montana. We go out there and he finally said, no, I really don't want to do this anymore. Oh yeah, you are going to do it. He said, no, I really don't. So he kind of retreated to that place up in Ruby Ridge. But he had an FFL, he had a federal firearms license, and he was doing what I was doing when I had one. He was getting guns for guys and no paperwork. And he was doing people favors, a lot of, you know, big time favors. And these two finks persuaded him to saw off a couple of shotgun barrels a little bit too short, like a quarter inch or a half inch too short.
And why did he do that? Did he know he was cutting them off too short? Did they want them a little bit shorter?
Maybe, you know, it's a fine line between 18 inches and maybe 17 and 7/8. I mean, that's all it matters. He may have done it on purpose. I don't really know. It doesn't matter. I don't care how long a shotgun barrel is or a rifle barrel or anything. I don't care at all. It makes no difference. And I don't give a damn. But that was good enough to get him arrested. And the Fed said, okay, now you are going to do what we say. You're going to infiltrate these places, or we're going to send you away to prison for a long time for these short shotgun barrels. And he still said no. You know, so that's what you do. I mean, he paid the price, but that's what you do. Once you're in the crosshairs, you at least say no. But I'm saying that's not good enough. You got to start shooting. Anybody that would do this to you is a filthy, stinking criminal. He's got to die.
After he shoots those two guys he's talking to.
He didn't shoot him.
No, he didn't. But say he does, you know, that, what else can he do? Then he's going to get, then they're coming after him. So,
well, they came after him anyway.
They
came after him anyway.
I know they did.
They came after you anyway. You have to
realize. And that was in 92.
You have to realize they're going to come after you anyway. So you might as well get your licks in, you know? But more guys do this. Now, look, here's what happened in Waco.
But shouldn't you be planning a bigger operation than to just gun down two guys?
Yeah, of course you should be. You should be. But you got to face the fact that they might come for you. So what are you going to do if they do? You know, what's you going to do? This is what you got to do, what they did in Waco. I mean, that should have gone down very peacefully. Those were Christians. Those were people who were in prayer at 10 o'clock in the morning. The informant, Rodriguez, told the ATF they'll be praying. You know, they'll be in their morning prayers. That's a good time to go in there and get their guns. Well, it didn't work out. And when the ATF, you know, started shooting, they shot back. And they killed four of them and wounded, I don't know how many, maybe a dozen. After a couple hours, the ATF had to raise their hands and beg for time out so they could come get their dead and wounded. That's how you handle this. You know, I have nothing but the utmost respect for those people, even though I don't agree with what, you know, their lifestyle or anything. Man, when the chips were down, they shot. And that's what you got to do. That's what Americans have to do, regardless. You know, that's how we change this thing. You may say, well, you're going to get, you sacrificed. Well, tough. You're going to get sacrificed anyway.
Yeah.
That's what they intend to do to you. I mean, what if they come in by mistake at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking you're a drug dealer? They barge in and knock your door down and kill your dog. And what do? You give up? No, you kill them.
But, you know, Bruce, when you talk like this, how is it that they just say, oh, well, he's the only real guy and we don't want to give him any publicity? Why don't they just do you in? It's not going to create that much publicity, is it? And why don't they just give you an accident or something? Why are you still around when all these other people are dead? Or they're cooperating?
Well, it's not as if they haven't tried.
Well, that's right. You have talked about that. But, you know, if they try, they can try again. Why would? We know how Jews operate. They keep going until they get what they want.
It's got to be done right. It's got to be done with that fine touch. I mean, you know, I expect it at any time. I'm always expecting it, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But there was a guy named Gordon Call. There was the Waco experience. And they do not want these things to be duplicated because that makes them look bad and weak. Now, yeah, I mean, I nearly croaked during my knee replacement. There was a mistake made by a visiting anesthesiologist. Oh, my goodness. What happened? Well, they don't know. This is in January in the hospital. I mean, I nearly croaked just a few months ago by some crazy situation by a visiting doctor.
I'd be careful of going to doctors and going into hospitals for surgery.
Well, yeah, but sometimes you have to go, and you got it. So I explained to my surgeon. I said, look, you know, this was a bad experience, right? He said, in 6,000 procedures, I've never seen anybody throwing up blood the way you were. I don't know what happened. Okay. I said, back in 2003, the Israelis tried to kill me 3 times in Vegas. Oh, really? So, I mean, he didn't say, oh my God, let's get the psychiatrist in there. He listened. He realized because something had happened during my surgery that he couldn't explain. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, yeah. It could happen any time. So what? I'm 66 years old. I'm not going to live forever. So I'm going to make it count. I'm going to do everything I can while I'm still here to make a change. That's all you can do.
Okay. So the other thing, well, this seems like it's just out of the blue, but I wanted to ask it earlier. Are you a libertarian?
No. I mean, in a way I am. But, I mean, libertarians, to me, are very weak people. They're not willing to fight. Libertarians aren't fighters. I'm a revolutionary.
I mean, you're like a freedom fighter. And then we have to ask, what kind of freedom are we going to end up with? What does it mean? Because you're anti-government. You want to overthrow this government, and what would happen after that? Because the natural thing someone says, well, what government are you going to put in place? Well, maybe you don't want any government. I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
I've come pretty close to anarchy, but there's one thing I do believe in, that the government has one legitimate function, and that is to provide debt-free currency. That's what Hitler did that destroyed the whole banking fraud. When he issued debt-free currency, just like Lincoln did, but, you know, Lincoln did it for very bad reasons because he wanted to kill all the Southerners, and he couldn't afford the interest rate with the bankers, 34%, so he said, well, let's just issue our own currency. And it turned out to be pretty successful. And that's what Hitler did with the Reichsmark. First he did it with scrip in certain, like, 5 industries, and then he spread it to debt-free currency total. And Germany blossomed virtually overnight. In 18 months, the 50% unemployment went to like 2% or something, you know, crazy thing. Everybody was working. Everybody was having paid vacations. Everybody was buying cars and houses, having a wonderful time in virtually overnight because of debt-free currency. And that's something I do believe in. That's what I think we should be fighting for, because that's the whole lifeblood of our society is currency. Right. It's got to be good. Right. Now, anyway, that's what I believe.
That's good. That's one thing. Now, but, you know, if you got that far and you didn't have a government that was opposed to Jews and had anti-Jewish policies in place, the Jews would just figure out how to take over and, you know, change that back again or something. So don't you think?
No, the people have to have the anti-Jewish policy.
Now, well, you can't get people in general to have it. You know, Hitler couldn't get the German people to have it. They had to make laws, and the people agreed to go along with it. You can't get people to understand.
Yeah, but that was the first time. That was the first time. They were the pioneers. They were the first ones to say, hey, Jews are bad. We can't let the Jews have anything to do with our society. They have to be quiet. They have to either go away, but they cannot have any influence over our lives anymore.
Yeah, but the people aren't going to do that. You have to have a government that makes laws about it. So I think you have to have a government to have any kind of...
Look, I mean, let's face it, if there had been a homicidal policy in Germany, all Hitler had to do was say, the Jews have to cease living. And very quietly, the 300,000 Jews that were living in Germany, if there were even that many, would have disappeared. They'd have just died because the people would have said, okay, fine, we'll kill them, if that's what you say. Because they knew what the Jews were. But obviously there was no homicidal policy because, anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm calling for that here. I'm saying save America, kill the Jews. You know, that's my overall policy right now. That's what I believe in. because I finally realized there's no nice way to deal with our problem, our Jewish problem. Jews have destroyed us. They have killed everything decent in the world, but using America as their instrument. So, I mean, that's what I stand for.
Well, then, but, you know, as a leader, why wouldn't you start killing Jews? Or why wouldn't you be forming some kind of group or something that was out quietly, secretly? And, of course, you want to destroy the CFR, is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to destroy that. You've been talking about that for a long time. And I don't know how well protected they are, but you'd think that why haven't there been some bombs going off at the CFR building? But nothing like this happens. It's just talk. So maybe if they know you're only talking, that's why they leave you alone.
Maybe so.
Well, you know, I mean, this is what people will think. So I don't know, you know.
I don't give a damn what people think anymore. You know, I don't really give a damn. I paid my price. I paid the price.
But how do you convert people if they say, well, this guy can't be real?
I don't care. I mean, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in saying what I want to say and creating awareness and creating new ideas, just like I did with the militia. I mean, that became many millions strong, even though it didn't really do anything. It got hammered and stopped. Okay, I'm going to try something else. I mean, I'm just one guy, but I'm doing a lot, and I will continue to do what I can to create this awareness and this idea. And people say, well, you're going to get killed. Well, I haven't been killed yet, and I'm still here. So I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can.
Do you think anybody's taking this seriously? I mean, I don't know. You know, people, everybody likes what you write, but nobody thinks about going out and doing any of these things. And then there's the idea some people have the idea, no violence. No, we shouldn't be performing any violence or we'll turn people off. It's all about, you know, trying to turn. Well, you know, it gets back to this thing about organizations. All the organizations want to be respectable, even though they're pro-white activism. Do you think any of those organizations have any value or are serious or what?
No.
Like those organizations that were that signed the New Orleans Protocol. I talked about that with Tom Metzger, so you said you didn't listen to that. Are you familiar with that at all? I think that
no,
was
I'm not, 2004
or something.
I know nothing.
Well, there's
a
bunch of these basically pro-white organizations. You know, David Duke started it and he wanted it, and a bunch of them got together there. And they signed this thing that they would not provoke any violent actions. They were against even talking about violence. And things like that. And they wouldn't attack one another and so on. But you're saying, you don't think there's any reason for anybody to be involved in those or to send them money or do anything like that. What do you think?
Well, I wasn't even aware of it, to be honest with you, so I can't say.
But you know these organizations. They're.
Yeah, I don't believe in any organization.
National Alliance, how about, you know, of course the big leader is gone now and it's not what it was, but all that.
It never was what it was, you know, it was just Pierce. And
well, what's your opinion of Pierce then?
I know, you know, pretty sure that he got that West Virginia property from order bank robbery money. I think it's pretty well known in the movement. That's where it came from Matthews. And the FBI knew it too. And I think they were okay with that. So, like I say, no organization can be trusted that I know of in this country.
So you think if people, if you know, your writing, if just your writing is enough, your articles is enough to bring about some, you know, enough people that will think differently and will stand up to it all. It's this huge thing to stand up to. It just doesn't seem, you know, at all possible. It's hard to know. I can say, well, you're doing what one person can do. You're doing what you do according to your best ideas. But it doesn't seem like it could have any success whatsoever. How are people going to, Are you depending, like so many, on this big crash that's going to come and all the hardship that we're going to experience?
I didn't quite understand the question.
You know, are you depending on, you know, the big financial crash and or the big, the destruction, the crash of the United States and all of the hardship that we're all going to experience when that happens? And then people are going to wake up and do something about it. Are you depending on that? As so many are.
No. What I'm pushing now, you know, I mean, would you have said in 1983 that one guy could have started something that millions of men would identify with within a few months?
Well, I don't know that ever happened. You know, I'm told that happened, but I was, basically, out of touch. And then I was even out of the country for all that period until.
Okay. Well, you weren't part of it. You weren't part of it.
No, I wasn't. No, not at all.
You weren't part of it. And to be honest with you, it was for men only.
Yeah, right.
That's how I set it up. It was for men. It wasn't for women because I was trying to delineate the difference between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there was no reason for you to be aware of it, but it was a big thing. And the government, you know, would be the first to admit it. The FBI told me it was, you know, a big thing, and they were very concerned. They didn't know what to do about it. They tried to co-opt me and make me another Truckman, you know, another Fink, because they didn't know how to stop it. It was just like it was just going crazy. And the more the Clintons did, the bigger it got. Anyway, look, at this point, I don't have any illusions. If I can get people to start shooting to prevent a Boston type of outrage, like, for example, the other night, well, a couple of months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, I gave a speech here in my little town in Idaho on gun control. And the actual speech is on my website. And the sheriff was there and one of his deputies, and because they were kind of pressured by the people to come listen to it. And I hit pretty hard. You know, I really hit hard. And my point was, if there's a home invasion here without a warrant, then the way to deal with it is like 5 rounds of buckshot zinging down the hallway. That's how you deal with it. Well, he was outraged. And he stood up finally and said he was speechless. He managed to make a speech despite that, and he denounced me and he stalked out of the place. But since then, he's been very polite. And that's how you have to deal with things. And if that's all I can do at this point is to create this very hardcore attitude amongst Americans, so we don't have another Boston where people are jerked out of their homes with their hands up for no reason. Not gonna.
You're talking about the Boston marathon bombing and the
Boston's strong, you know.
Yeah.
And these poor dumb bastards allowed themselves to be jerked out of their homes with their hands up. Okay, well that's not going to happen. We got to do the Waco thing here. Over and over and over and over.
But ordinary people aren't going to do that. That's
well, what do you know? What do you know? Who are you to say that? I mean, why are you so presumptuous to say something like that?
Well,
this is America. This is America. We got some real hardcore guys in this country. Really hardcore guys that are on a hair trigger right now. They are pissed off. They're angry.
They're probably not the ones that are going to be pulled out of their
home. Well, you know, you're just being really negative right now. Maybe you're just doing the devil's advocate thing.
Yeah,
maybe you're doing
sure.
the devil's advocate thing, but I don't buy what you're saying. You know, this is America. We got a lot of guns. We got more guns than Pennsylvania has more licensed deer hunters than the Chinese army. You don't realize the power in this country, the power. And there's nothing as dangerous as a deer hunter. Let me tell you, deer hunters are very cunning guys that can get up very close to very nervous animals and kill them. Well, what do you think they could do to a cop or a soldier or an IRS agent? They could do anything they want. So that's my position.
Okay. Let me just say right here, so that if people, you know, want to have a different approach than I have, They can call in right now at 1-830-443-4911 and talk to Bruce directly. 830-443-4911. You know, I'll take your call. Now, I'm looking at the email, and it's just Stuart, but I don't think I'm going to bother with what he says because it's pretty much the same as what I said he would say, and he said. So he thinks you're full of it, but that's his
He likes
Mark Kernke in the Liberty.
Well, thank God he thinks I'm full of it. I'd be nervous if he thought I was a great guy.
Okay. Right. Now, so let me let's see what's come up here. Let me say that let's get back to Louis Beam for a minute. You know, what is his position today? Because he seems like he has changed his mind a lot, and he doesn't have anything new and recent on his website. And I know you're not responsible for him, but he's the only one you mentioned as being that you're being friends with from this group of people, and from his introductory passage, he likes the Chris Hedges. And he's saying, talking about the whole world resisting. You know, he's gone beyond the racial thing. He wants all people, freedom loving people, to stand up together against tyranny. And he wants a worldwide bond of freedom loving people. Says it's developing. We may not agree on many things, but it's necessary to resist and so on. But it just seems like it's words. He's not going to do anything too much. And he hasn't written anything for a long time. I'm looking for the other thing that he said. Yeah, here it is. In his Let's Be Honest essay, he wrote about Let's Be Honest, and he said what concerns him is the poisoning of the environment, corruption in government, corporations without hearts, the military-industrial complex, the rights of individual versus the state, drug war, the CIA, hungry people, and racism. All these things come up, you know, in general, and he's moved kind of toward the left. He's also, like Tom Metzger, he doesn't like the right wing very much anymore, and he thinks that that's all been the problem, and it's all been infiltrated, and he says, while it is... He says, let's be honest, I know that you are concerned about white racism. While it is Jewish and black racism which concern me, because you can take that two different ways. But he's becoming more universalist, and so has David Duke. Is that just a matter of talking in order to overcome the past accusations that they, you know, that they're haters and so on? Or what do you think this is the move that people are making? Or what is it with these rights?
Well, Lewis was never, you know, he'd be the first to tell you, I think, that he was never that racial, even though he was the grand dragon of the Texas Ku Klux Klan.
He sounded like it. I heard some speeches where he sounded like it was really fired.
I know, because he was the grand dragon. But he told me that he got into that because he came back from Vietnam. You know, he'd been seriously injured by Agent Orange over there.
Right.
And came back to Texas and was interested in fighting communism. That was his main ambition after the war. So he looked around at various organizations, the Birch Society, probably Liberty Lobby. I don't know. He looked at everything. And he thought that the Klan probably had the most active attitude in terms of action orientation. So he got involved with them because of his desire to fight communism, pretty much like me. He's a very decent guy and very tolerant, and he gets along with everybody. When he tried to strangle Deng Xiaoping in Houston one time, at a parade, he jumped out and got his hands around his throat and got arrested and thrown in jail with a bunch of blacks, thinking that, you know, the cops were thinking they were going to get him killed. And he was able to talk to these guys, and they, you know, there was really no problem because he emanates a calm decency. He's a very, very manly guy. I don't know anything about his, you know, these latest things. I haven't been in touch with him for a long time, but he's right. You know, the right wing movement is a total shambles and totally infiltrated by feds and cops.
Okay, let me stop you on that, because I've got an email question or a comment here from Hattie Scott that I think is worthwhile. And then I got to check the phone lines again. He says that you're repeating gossip, movement gossip, that you haven't really checked. He said that he had asked Metzger about the claim that his proceeds for some years were going to Morris Dees in the SPLC, and Metzger said that that was not accurate, that the money went to the family of the dead Ethiopian. I think maybe Morris Dees was the person who collected it for them, because he was the attorney. He was the attorney for the Ethiopian family.
Am I incorrect that the money kept coming in and Morris Dees kept taking it and giving it to the Ethiopian family? Am I incorrect about that?
The email box may have been turned over to Morris Dees to collect everything that came in for the Ethiopian.
Shouldn't
maybe he had no power over that. That was a court order. That court had taken, that was part of his property that was taken over. So he had no
power. I mean, he didn't have his mailing list and send out a letter to everybody say, hey, cool it. Let's not send any more money because that's not.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Okay. What you're saying is he didn't notify his contributors that the money was no longer going to him.
Right.
Yeah, well, I guess there you go.
Is that movement gossip or is that the truth?
Well, that's very good to clear that up. Thanks. Okay. Thanks for that.
Okay.
Now, he also says regarding Dr. Pierce, and you know he's kind of speaks up a lot for Pierce, there was no evidence as to how much money he received from the order. Oh, I don't know. You didn't say anything about that I recall. But he says newspaper reports at the time said that that Pierce got $50,000 from the order, which was the same amount that a number of other people got, who were also not prosecuted. Well, I guess Pierce was not prosecuted. In fact, nobody was ever prosecuted for receiving order money. That's true. So the inference that somebody believed to have received some cash from the order must have been working for the feds is unwarranted. Did you say that? Did you infer that people who received money from the order must have been working for the feds? I don't recall.
Sure, of course. You get money from the order, and the feds know about it, and they don't do anything to you, then you're okay with the feds. I mean, that's pretty obvious to me.
You think the order was working for the feds?
No, I don't know that. I don't think so. I mean, I've never thought that. I think there were feds in it, but I don't think Matthews was. I think he's a pretty sincere guy, you know, but what do I know? I mean, I'm just.
Yeah, right. You didn't know them.
Yeah.
All right. So what is your attitude then racially? Because you're kind of, you know, I know that you have a lot of sympathy for the Native American Indians. And I think your wife is a Native American Indian at this time.
That's right.
But you talk very strongly for whites, and you say, yeah, white people have to run things. But, and again, it goes back to this country. If we would overthrow the government and do everything the way you would like it to be done, what would we end up with? We would not have we'd have different banking, different currency. What else?
Well, I think all the Jews would be gone. That would be uppermost in my mind.
How would we do that? I like that. I like that, you see, but how would that be done? If not by law, if not by passing some kind of laws and saying.
No, it would just be something that the Americans would want and be authorized to do. Because.
Oh, you think
know,
people independently, we would just have independent citizens functioning on their own doing this stuff?
Yeah. We don't need government.
We don't need police. You think we can function without police forces and so on.
We can function very well without police forces. We don't function very well with them. I mean, they are the biggest problem we have right now.
Well, I think you sound a lot like Alex Linder. Do you pay much attention to Alex Linder?
I don't know. I don't know him.
Oh, you don't know. You must know of him.
No, I don't know him.
Really? Okay.
No.
Well, he runs that VNN forum. You know, VNN forum, Vanguard News Network and all that.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I can't quite imagine that. I just cannot. I don't think white people are, who's going to take care of the thieves and the crooks and the crimes and so on? And you think that's not going to stop? You know, if you think that's going to stop, I don't know.
That's why we have guns. I mean, you know, if it's
so
not
it's
illegal.
It's going to be like the Wild West.
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, that's,
well, I don't know.
That's what we need. That's what we need. That's exactly what we need.
Okay. It'll be like the Wild West. We'll have sheriffs.
The West wasn't that wild. You know, that's kind of a myth. Uh-huh. But we need more of it. We definitely need street justice, frontier justice for criminals. We don't need prisons. You know, the prisons don't do any good.
Well, they had prisons then. They had jails, that's for sure. And they had a lot of people they threw in there. They were
a lot of
outlaws. You know, there's a lot of outlaws.
But we can deal with outlaws. We can deal with outlaws on the street. We don't need to put them away where they're going to get out eventually and be a lot worse than when they went in. So we don't need that. We need to deal with them.
What do you do with the outlaw? You just shoot them down so everybody has the right to shoot when they think somebody needs to be shot?
Well, yeah. We let the police do that. I mean, but the problem is the police do it to us, too. So, and we're not allowed to defend ourselves from the police.
Well, you're real comfortable with guns, so I guess that seems a possibility to you. But what about people who really aren't people who want to carry guns around and shoot people down if they get in their way or whatever? They want society to be made more orderly.
They're basically cowards. They're basically cowards, and they want somebody else to do it.
Well,
so
you're
I'm
never
saying,
gonna,
no,
you
let's
know, there's a lot of different
take care of ourselves. I'm saying let's take care of ourselves and stop looking to these thugs that we hire at great expense and great danger to ourselves. We have to take care of ourselves. It's a simple way, but it works. I saw it in Rhodesia. You know, they took care of themselves against terrorism. We helped as much as we could, but the farmers they dealt with the terrorists themselves. So we could do the same thing here. It's not a problem. We just have to get over this infantile mentality we have that somebody's got to take care of us.
You'd have people like the mafia in cities like crazy, and you'd have these wars going on all the time.
Well, the mafia's got to be wiped out. Mafia's got to be wiped. There's a hell of a lot more of us than there is of the mafia, and we can wipe them out easily.
You see the way people are bought off. So all these people would be bought off by the mafia, and it'd just go on and on. Look at these wars down in Mexico, drug wars and so on. That is not an environment.
It's that way because guns are illegal in Mexico and only criminals have them. No, we can deal with the mafia. We can deal with the Justice Department. We can deal with the FBI, the CIA, the IRS. We can deal with all the terrorist organizations, the FBI. FBI is the worst right now. I mean, they are the ones that create all these terrorist situations here.
Oh, yeah. Well, real quick, I heard you talking about the Boston bombing, or I saw it or something. Or I guess it was on another radio program. Or it was Shady. It was Sandy Hook you were talking about. So that's a government operation. I think so, but you think so, too. And then what about the Boston Marathon bombing? You're very much of a conspiracy believer. Right?
No, I understand the way the government works. You know, I understand about the FBI. I mean, all you got to know about is World Trade Center 1993, and then you get the whole picture. Mm-hmm. The FBI built the bomb, supplied the bomb for the World Trade Center 1993. That's well known and documented. Imad Ali Salem was their informant. He built the bomb, gave it to the guys. If they put it in the right place against the spine of that building, it could have broken the central spine, and it could have tipped over into the other tower. That's what the FBI is. It's a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. So we got to.
Well, so then everything, all of these events that have been called terrorist events, including the latest Boston Marathon bombing, was a government operation. PSYOP.
Well, I mean, let's face it. We got this thing called crisis actors there in Boston. They were also in Sandy Hook. I mean, what the hell? We don't even know who got hurt.
I read about the crisis actors too, but then some of these people are saying, "Oh, now we're down on crisis actors now. It's all done in the studio. You know, it's all done by camera work and so on. All this fancy stuff they can do. None of it's real. It's all in digital. It's all."
Well, I don't know. I don't know, but I know that we got crisis actors, and they're a bunch of fakers.
So. Well, we do have crisis actors. You're right, and they show pictures of these people looking like they have incredibly horrible wounds, and they look so real. And they're sitting there fixing them up, you know, and then they're going to go out there. And why do they have to make it so real for these people who are supposed to be training in how to do this or something? I don't know. When they know it's not real while they're doing it, it's kind of strange how they're kind of practicing how to make all this stuff look so real. And it looks as real as anything that we see in any of these events. Certainly in the Boston.
And why do these atrocities happen during drills?
You know, that's another thing. I agree with you. I'm on board with you there, but a lot of people have a hard time. There's your dog. He's been quiet for a long time. He probably says, "Is it time to get this over?" Well, we've got a few minutes, Bruce. I got in most everything I wanted to ask you about. Is there something that you would like to talk about that I haven't, or you want to leave?
No, I think we've done a pretty good job. You don't have anybody questioning me, or you don't have anybody who wants to talk? That's okay.
No, nobody's called in. People are kind of hesitant to call this program for some reason, not friendly enough to them. I go back to the email box, but let's see. See if there's anything else there. Simplistic view. Well, here's Hadding coming back again. He says, your view of the order money situation is simplistic. To prosecute somebody, the feds would have to be able to show that the person should have known that the money came from illegal activity. In fact, the feds couldn't even really prove who got what, since Matthews was dead so far as Dr. Pierce was concerned. It was all hearsay. Is that a valid criticism or not?
I mean,
that the feds have to be able to prove.
I mean, look today. I mean, if anybody gets a dime from an Islamic organization, you know, the FBI runs them down. But you get a bank robbery, a bunch of bank robbers giving money to people, and the FBI didn't say a thing? Come on. That stinks. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, I know about the FBI because they were running the militia of Montana, and the same guy came to see me. So I know what these guys do, and they create phony opposition. And as I say, if you're not willing to look at World Trade Center 1993, you're not willing to look at anything. You're not really willing to consider how diabolical those people were, those FBI agents, Antisev and Davis or whatever her name was, the two twerps that persuaded Salem to build a bomb. Now, it did $500 million in damage to that one tower. It injured 1,000 people, and it killed 6. That's the FBI. Mm-hmm. So, come on.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, well, he's still trying to defend Dr. Pierce. He says if the Fort Smith sedition trial hadn't fallen flat as a fishing expedition, then a lot of other people, including Dr. Pierce, probably would have been prosecuted.
Okay, let me talk about Pierce. Now, he put in his bulletin that J.B. Campbell was now a coordinator or a representative of National Alliance in L.A. I never said that. I never agreed to that, but okay, fine. So I put together a big meeting in L.A., a membership drive. So Pierce sends out this maniac named Will White Williams to speak to all the people that I brought together for this huge luncheon meeting in San Fernando Valley. So what does Williams do when he gets up? He starts insulting all these people and ridiculing them. And they became furious. And so Williams turns to me and says, well, Bruce, what do you think? I thought, well, you son of a bitch. How dare you come here?
Well, how did he insult them? What was he saying? Was he just...
Well, there were Christians there and there were other people.
Okay. He got on that anti-Christian thing.
Huh? Rival groups for the National Alliance. And so he's putting these people down.
Okay.
So it was a total catastrophe. So I called Pierce. I called Pierce. I said, what the hell are you doing sending this asshole out here? Williams, what do you mean? Well, he just made a shambles of this meeting that I put together for you. Well, he said, I heard that you did the same thing in Las Vegas and in San Francisco. Well, then what are you doing, Pierce? What are you doing? Well, he said, I really don't have any choice. What do you mean? Well, he's my business partner. Oh, really? So, you know, Pierce was nothing. He was just a professor, a punk.
Okay. All right. Well, that's your opinion of Pierce. It's good to hear. I want your, you know, I want to hear people's opinions of other people in the movement back in these times. And I don't consider it to be irresponsible gossiping or rumor mongering or anything. You know, everybody has their point of view and people can make up their own mind. Well, we're down to about 30 seconds now, Bruce. So I want to thank you so very much for coming on. I think it turned into a great program. We have had a lot of listeners, and even though we didn't have callers, but that gave us more time to talk. And so,
let me just add one thing. Will White Williams was Special Forces, a captain in the Green Berets, CIA. So, I mean, that says it all. That's all I got to say.
Well, a lot of these people were.
Yeah, that's right. The whole movement is full of these guys. So be careful.
Okay. Well, I wish you well. I hope you just keep moving along here and your health holds up. You're not that old, really, at all. So good luck to you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. And on Monday, Hadding will be doing George Lincoln Rothschild.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.